This is an ABC podcast.
Hello there, Nikolai Bailhart's with you for The Country Hour, and Happy New Year's. On the program today, Australia's drought has meant that buyers for high-quality wheat have had to look to other markets, American and Canadian producers, to try and meet that shortfall. So we'll talk today about whether or not that could potentially mean some reputational damage for the Australian industry in terms of being able to supply a product. Also on the program today, as we all know, touch is a very powerful sense. Now new research is suggesting that plants also have pretty strong feelings when it comes to touch. So this new research that's just been published has looked at how the amount of touch that a plant receives can slow its growth and can have significant yield cuts in terms of agricultural production. So more on that too.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Well, to start today, though, it is, of course, the first day of a new year, and that usually brings about some changes. This year, some significant changes, particularly when it comes to trade. As of today, the 1st of January, the China-Australia Free Trade Agreement will do away with tariffs on some pretty key agricultural exports, products like wine, fruit and vegetables, and seafood. And it isn't the only trade agreement coming into force. The CPTPP, that's the Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, very easy to say, that also came into force on Sunday, giving Australian exporters access to a significant market. Now, the ABC's John Daly spoke with the Federal Agriculture Minister, David Littleproud.
Yeah, well, look, obviously we're seeing a further reduction with the China Free Trade Agreement on dairy, on seafood, on wine and vegetables. Another milestone moment that's continued to remove tariffs. We've gone from some tariffs around 30% back to zero. And that means we get more money in farmers' pockets and into regional communities' pockets.
Now, it's not just the Chinese trade agreement that is going to be potentially reducing tariffs for Australian farmers. There's also the Trans-Pacific Partnership. What's the significance of that deal coming into force as of the 30th of December?
Well, look, the TPP gives us access to a $13.7 trillion marketplace, and that's around a $15.4 billion benefit to the Australian agricultural sector, which means we've now, for the first time, put in an agricultural councillor in Mexico City and another one in Chile, which will mean that they are getting rid of those non-tariff barriers to be able to give market access commodity by commodity. So we're taking this very serious, the TPP-11, because it opens up more opportunities. We're not only looking to the north for market access, but to our east and to our west. And now this will mean that we'll be able to give our producers more options, more ability to look at different markets to get better commodity prices from around the world.
If we look at the world and the situation as it is, it seems like trade barriers are, if anything, they're growing rather than reducing. So getting stuff like this over the line would be quite the task, I'd imagine.
Definitely. So reducing the tariffs is one thing, but the non-tariff barriers is a major piece of this, the second part of this. And that's why in the last budget we put $51 million into new agricultural councillors that give us market access commodity by commodity, but also give us the scientists back in Canberra to be able to do the work to work through the scientific barriers of that market access as quickly as we possibly can. Speed to market is so important, and that's why we see we can trade with the world. We'll get better returns at the farm gate and better returns through regional communities. It's not just farmers that benefit from this. It's also small businesses in these small communities that support agriculture that benefit from better commodity prices, and that's what's happened.
Now, on the flip side, but definitely the benefits of having low tariffs for Australian exports is undeniable. But what about the removal of tariffs on imports from some of these nations? Is that also included?
Well, look, a lot of our tariffs have been removed previously. We've given them market access. And you can't trade is a two-way street. You can't have your cake and eat it too. The reality is we've got to back ourselves. We produce the best food and fibre in the world. We've put in place country of origin labelling so that our consumers can go into the supermarket with a two-second look, can make sure they look for a green and gold kangaroo and a barcode on the bottom to make sure they've got the best ingredients in the world, which is Australian. And so we're given that choice, but we've got to understand we're a nation of 25 million people. We produce enough food for 75 million. So if we don't engage the world, if we don't have free trade agreements, then we don't have regional communities. We don't need farmers. So these trade agreements have changed our perspective, but let me tell you that they're better for us. Our only inhibitor is our ability to produce, and I've put my hand up and said I'm on the journey with NFF to get us to a $100 billion industry by 2030, and we'll be making some announcements in the new year. If we take ourselves to $100 billion, let me tell you, that will make regional rural Australia one of the heavy lifters in this nation's economy, as we already are, and the real wealth will be created in agriculture and regional Australia. And I say to metropolitan Australians, have a good look, because you need to come out and get part of this, otherwise you're going to miss the boat.
And is there anything else on the horizon that Australian farmers should be getting excited about when it comes to trade restrictions?
Oh, well, look, obviously, Trade Minister Birmingham is working closely on finalising the Indonesian agreement. We finalised Peru. The TPP-11 comes into a place, a $13.7 trillion marketplace, which will give us around $15.4 billion worth of benefit. I mean, agriculture is sexy again. The story of agriculture is just ad-rain.
That's the Federal Agriculture Minister David Littleproud speaking with John Daly. Well, as mentioned, zero tariffs on a number of different seafood exports to China come into effect today. So under the China-Australia FTA, tariffs on oysters, salmon, trout, rock lobster and other types of seafood are being eliminated. Rock lobster exporter Andrew Ferguson says the reduction in tariffs will make it much easier to sell directly into China.
As it's been phased in, it started at 14%. Which is quite a considerable amount of tariff on a product. Considering we're competing on a world market of other imports into China, we've been looking, as it's phasing in, at going more direct to the market, whereas we're being more indirect through wholesales in other countries but into China. So as it's phased in, it's given us more opportunity to go direct to the market.
Are there any particular markets that you're focusing on within China?
Basically different provinces. There's different culture differences between the provinces in China, and some provinces like different products from different parts of the world, and we don't find all of China takes southern rock lobster. Different species, so the Canadian lobster is a big competitor. The WA lobster species is a competitor to our species, and then we've got crabs and all sorts of crabs from around the world. So you find the northern part of China as a big crab market, and does take larger lobsters, but it is fairly specific to China market on where the species go. Shanghai is a big market for our species, with the wedding market. More the smaller lobsters. So once you understand the market, you do target the different provinces and the different cultures in the market for a different size ranges, and it takes a while to work it all out, but having a free trade agreement has certainly helped us in that area.
And what effect do you think zero tariffs will have on prices?
Well, like I said, we are competing on a world market for imports into China, and any help is good in that area, because we do have a very sought after species. It's probably top of the tree as compared to most, or it is, it's the most sought after, but not all the market can pay for it. So we really are looking for those real niche markets that can afford it, and certain celebratory times it will be in high demand. It does go through different phases during the year of depending on what the celebrations are, where it's sought after more than others, and so we have to sort of play that market, and sometimes it's difficult, sometimes it's easy, but at the moment it's just gone off the boil a little bit, and we've got Chinese New Year coming up at the end of January, and it's early February, so we will see a spike there. So we just got to work within those spikes in the market, and then hopefully we can stop fishermen from fishing during the low times. It's sort of trying to fit the marketing around all those things.
There are a few busy events coming up, but how optimistic are you about the market long term?
I'm fairly optimistic. We've seen a pretty good year so far, considering we started back in the first of October. We've seen, we've had two reasonable months. October was a good month sales-wise, good demand, good amount of celebrations for whatever reasons, and then November's been reasonably good. Then it goes a little bit quiet into December, which is pretty usual, really. And then we see it'll pick up again in January, then sort of go quiet after Chinese New Year, then pick up again as we heard it head into towards May. So ebbs and flows all the time, but I'm very optimistic about the market. It's, if we can feed the market when it wants it, we hold our market place. It's always hard, though, if you lose a segment of the market to get it back in whatever product you're working within. So the quota system is working very well in South Australia. It's very well managed fishery. We've had high catches, and fishermen are working with us now and stopping and starting. And so we work like that. It can only get better.
Andrew Ferguson speaking with Leonie Thorne.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
It is 16 past 12. My name is Nikolai Bailhartz. Well, electronic ear tags are considered an unwanted expense by a number of farmers, but for others, they're providing a useful way to record data about their animals. The tags, of course, have been mandatory for sheep and goats born in Victoria since the start of 2017. But even before then, livestock producers across the country were using them. Anthony Shepherd, the director of livestock consultancy Sheep Matters, says electronic tags has been a game changer for the industry.
I'm based at Cootamundra, north of Wagga Wagga, and I've got clients all around Australia who've been using EID for up to 15 years now, where it's not mandatory and we're using it to collect important traits relative to the breeding objectives of the client. And on those traits collected, we can then make good decisions about what to do with the sheep and, you know, join them to particular genetics or sell them or which ones to keep, not to keep, relative to what they're doing or not doing. And as a tool, something like an auto drafter is a tool to then help you take, you can draft out on information that's collected against that EID tag.
So EID, when it was made mandatory, it was considered by a lot of people as an extra cost and an extra hassle. But for you, the advantages outweigh the negatives?
Well, the clients are telling me that, you know, I've got about 1.3 million breeding ewes under my watch with clients that have EID tags in commercial sheep when they don't have to. And every year they're putting in the next lot of EID tags into the next lot of ewes coming through, their maiden ewes. And we're getting a really, really highly productive line of flock ewes all around Australia because of what we're selecting on them and versus what commercially some aren't doing, and we get rid of the low performance and get them out of the system.
So what's involved, I guess, to record and log that data against the tags?
So, you know, you can basically start with, there's the cost of the tag. So outside Victoria, it's about $1.25, $1.30 for a tag. And then something like a reader, basic reader, you get away with about a stick reader with some software. It's probably a $2,000 investment as a startup. And then you can add on with an indicator, and then you're probably another $2,500. Auto drafters, probably that's the big end. You know, and that's a $20,000. And there's the handlers, and they're $20,000 to $25,000. But so a lot of the people I do stuff with, they start with just the basic, that reader that can actually collect data, and it's got an indicator on it. And you can actually use it to make decisions. Again, we can collect data and then make a draft list on that actual stick reader. And you can be as basic as then scan those sheep down a race and then rattle the ones that need to go to the meat ram versus the wool ram as an example and draft them at the end of the race. And, you know, it's not a big, big investment as a startup and being introduced and learning about EID on a small scale. And then there's the software, and the software is some basic software, and I do a lot of data with a lot of people around Australia, and we're using, you know, I use the cloud, and we've got people that I train online, and people want to learn about it, and they're finding more about their sheep, and they didn't realise what the possibilities are. Yeah.
So what are the main data sets that people are recording on the individual animal?
Yeah, so, you know, typically in a merino, obviously there's the wool data, and so there's a lot of, we collect the individual traits on greasy fleece weight and the micron and the yield, and then there's reproduction, So pregnancy scanning, and we need to record, perform, you know, this, what we call status, or their pregnancy status against them, being a dry or a single or a twin if they got pregnant early or late. Then there's weight, and there's weight gain. We do a lot of condition scoring, so where they are, what condition they are relative to if they got pregnant to a twin or single, and what we need to do to manage that for the energy requirement of those ewes. And what I look over long term is then repeat performance of that same ewe, and is it doing the same? Is it a good employee continuously, or is it suddenly a high performance and then low performance in this, you know, as time goes on? So it's about looking at which ones we're trying to select on, and relative to the breeding objectives we will collect. And it's all about collecting it when it's opportunity, not specially getting them in. So preg scanning, they'll be in, so we can collect data. Shearing, they're in a shed, we can collect data. Weaning, we can do a weaning weight, they're in there, we can collect data. It's all about opportunity.
And with the auto drafter, what ways is the auto drafter typically used? What lines does it draft into?
So typically there's a weight component, so it can draft on weight. And I've got clients in feedlots that we can, you know, which ones are doing weight and weight gain. That's a typical one. Let's say if we were then, we had some data on, say we had a lot of people do pregnancy scanning, and they might then run, or and we've got that against that information against the EID tag, and then before lambing, they'll bring them in, well, they should bring them in and give them a pre-lamb treatment of a vaccine and maybe a drench, and then at that point they can go into their paddocks, and you can actually use the auto drafter then to put them through, and you can draft on their pregnancy status.
So what would your advice be to farmers, whether they're in Victoria and the tags are mandatory, or whether they're in other states and they're optional? What would your advice be about getting the best value out of them?
Oh, opportunity. I mean, the commodity prices on sheep and wool is in the highest index historically ever. And what a great opportunity to have the right sheep on your place. And so if markets do drop, which they do, markets go up and down, you've ranked them on performance. And there's a huge opportunity for being smarter with what animals you're running. And also, you know, this season has not been kind in a lot of areas regarding drought. Supplementary feed is costing a lot of money. I'd rather spend that $400 a tonne barley on the right sheep, not the wrong sheep.
Anthony Shepherd from Sheep Matters speaking with Angus Verley. Just a quick reminder too, one change that does take effect as of today, being the start of the new year. If you are a Victorian producer and you buy in sheep from interstate, it is now mandatory that post-breeder electronic tags are fitted to those animals. And you can find more details on that side of things on the AgVic website.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Well, as we all know, touch can be a very powerful sense for humans, but new research is suggesting that plants can also have quite strong feelings when it comes to touch. Some new research from La Trobe University, which just been published, has looked at the amount of times that a plant gets touched and how that can slow its growth. Professor Jim Wheeler is Research Director of the La Trobe Institute for Agriculture.
What we were doing is we were actually doing some experiments to see how plants respond to, say, some general stresses, whether it be drought, high light and other things like that. And we do that sometimes by applying some chemicals as well, just to mimic those treatments. And what we noticed that in the control plants where we were just gently applying water, we were also getting a response. So we had to kind of sort that out and see what was happening. And what we found out is that the plants were responding to a very gentle touch or any very gentle mechanical stimulation when we applied it. So that's how we actually started to look at that, whereas normally what we'd be doing is looking at how plants respond to stresses like high light, drought, salt, other things like that.
And you found had some quite interesting results about, so when a plant is touched, how much things can change in terms of that plant's production.
Yeah, well, what we found is it's been known for, I must stress that, it's been known for like maybe 30, 40 years that repeated touching or mechanical stimulation of plants does retard their growth. And that's probably best seen maybe if you're near some windswept areas by the ocean and things like that. You can see the plants are often a lot smaller and things like that. But what wasn't known is why, what is the molecular basis of this? So like what we found was that upon touching them very gentle, about 2,000 or 3,000 genes, which would be basically, you could think of them as information packets or instructions of genes are, and that's what they do a certain job in the cell. And what happens is 2,000 or 3,000 of these change in expression or in amount. And the ones that basically are involved in defense are actually increase in amounts, and the ones that are involved in driving growth decrease in amounts. So the end of it would be if the plants would have turned on a defense response, but may not be growing as fast as they might normally would.
Okay, so it is the understanding is that it is the plant saying, "Oh, I'm under stress here. I'm being attacked. I need to respond," and that's the priority.
Yeah, well, that's what we see by when we look at the expression of all the different genes or the information in the cell, and that's what it's saying. Yes, it's changing more to a defense response rather than a growth response.
How much of a difference can it make in terms of plant growth restriction?
Well, it does depend. Like when we did it, like we were just doing single touches, so they weren't actually restricted in growth. But it's well known in the literature that, like, you know, again, repeated mechanical stimulation can retard the growth of plants 20-30% and things like this. So it is quite significant.
Does it matter what kind of touch it is, as in whether it's a human touch, whether, it, like you say, it's kind of a water or a chemical or even an insect?
Look, we haven't tried them all, but we don't think it is. Like, we've touched it gently with a paintbrush. We've sprayed things very gently on it. We've done it a few different ways, and it doesn't seem to make any difference. Once they perceive that mechanical touch or stimulation and things like that, they tend to turn on this response. So we would be saying that, you know, that it's not, you know, plants haven't evolved to actually respond to human touch because they were around a lot longer than we are and things like that. But that is just mimicking what would happen in nature, whether it be an insect that would land on them, whether it be animals that would be starting to eat them, like, or things like that. So that's what we would say, that it's actually perceiving. So it's a very, for us, that what was surprising is that they're so sensitive to their surrounding environment.
One of the other interesting things that you point out too is that, you know, a lot of this touch kind of occurs naturally without any human interference, if I can put it that way. So when plants either rub up against each other or when insects land on them, and sometimes those insects can be beneficial to the plants too.
Yep, exactly. So that's for us is trying to sort this out. Again, it's very interesting when you look at this compared, like, to what you might call natural or wild systems to agricultural systems. You could think in the wild, plants do want these defences or do need these defences because they need to be ready to respond fast when threats come. But then if they do it too much, they're actually retarding their growth. So it's a question of kind of having that balance, if you want to call it, like, you know, having your radar up, if you want to call it a defence system, so you detect it early. But maybe in agricultural systems where we actually kind of manage systems quite closely, plants don't need this defence system. So therefore, that if we now could actually go back to crop plants and look to see how sensitive they are to touch, and that if we abolish it, or kind of, like, you know, by looking at variation or kind of optimize it, that we might be able to get a growth increase in crop plants.
And yeah, and so is that where you see the opportunities lying in things like breeding those kind of tolerances out a little bit?
Yes, that's where we would see the translation of this work, because this was done on a model system in a laboratory, but that's where we would see the interest or the translation of it would be, is to see, look at crop varieties or crop plants and look at different varieties and see, can we actually dampen the touch or mechanical stimulation response, and then see, do those plants grow better?
Because I guess one of the interesting things too that springs to mind is, you know, as time agriculture tends to be getting more intensive, people tend to be kind of planting crops closer together or vegetables or whatever the case may be, kind of closer together, so therefore there will probably be more interaction. So you're kind of not necessarily saying, well, hang on, we need to space everything out. There might be other ways around it.
Oh yeah, no, I think, like, we have to be realistic. Like, I think trying to space and things out so they don't touch each other would be totally impractical, I would suggest. But there might be other ways around it, as to kind of, yeah, to kind of maybe damping the response a little bit in crop plants and things like that, so that way you can still get the plant in density without any negative impacts on growth and things like that. And that would be important as well for maybe horticultural systems that are often grown in glass houses or under glass and other things like that, where, again, the plants are largely protected. It's, you know, it's a very clean environment without insects, without any disease threats, not without any, but they're kept out. And therefore, that this response, which maybe helps them to fight those things, they don't need it anymore. So again, it could be kind of maybe optimized by breeding to actually be to get the best growth possible.
So what are your next steps? What's the next kind of phase of the research that you want to undertake?
Well, what we'll probably do in it, there's one or two things that we'll probably do in it. We'll probably keep almost a model plan to try to understand the regulation of it, because if we can identify the regulators of all these genes that change, we can then target them, get rid of them, and see what happens to the plants when they don't have that response. So that will be one thing that we'll do in the model plant. And then in the crop plants, what we'll probably do is get some crop plants. We do work on rice and barley and wheat a little bit here, so we'll now probably put them into our grow chambers here that are kind of protected, where they are individual plants, and we'll probably test the touch response in them to see how much of it is in crop plants, because we don't know what the breeding of crop plants over, you know, we've been breeding crop plants for over 5,000 years, really. We don't know how much of it will be there, and if it has been bred out, or if they're actually very sensitive.
Interesting one to keep an eye on. That's Professor Jim Wheeler. He's Research Director of the La Trobe Institute for Agriculture.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Well, it is 12:30. That means it's time to head off to the Bureau of Meteorology and find out how things are looking. Rod Dixon is Senior Forecaster on duty. Afternoon, Rod.
Hi, Nikolai.
And Happy New Year's. How are things looking on this first day of 2019?
Yes, Happy New Year to you. We've got a pretty clear and sunny day across Victoria today. Once again, warm in the north, with temperatures already nudging the mid-30s across the Murray. But the only chance of getting wet today is just a very slight risk of a shower about the eastern ranges, possibly one or two thunderstorms about the far eastern ranges. But really, for most areas, a fine and sunny day. As I mentioned, still warm in the north. Temperatures forecast today up around the mid to high 30s across northern Victoria, with temperatures around about 38 degrees at Albury-Wodonga, 37 at Wangaratta, 37 also for Echuca as well, and 37 for Swan Hill. But it should be milder closer to the coast, with southerly winds freshening up during the afternoon with the sea breeze, keeping temperatures generally around the mid-20s across southern Victoria today. Then we're going to see pretty much more of the same on Wednesday. There is just a slightly greater chance of some showers or isolated thunderstorms about the east during the afternoon, mainly about the eastern ranges. And there'll be a bit more cloud cover across southern Victoria during the morning, but that should break up to a sunny afternoon. Remaining clear and sunny across the north of the state. Once again, temperatures in the high 30s across northern Victoria on Wednesday. And temperatures in the low to mid-20s across the south, with that cooler southerly wind providing some milder conditions. Then as we head towards Thursday, a little bit warmer across most areas, temperatures reaching into the low 40s across northwestern Victoria, but fairly light winds, and afternoon sea breezes should keep conditions mildest about the coast on Thursday. Another fine and sunny day. Once again, just a chance of some isolated showers, possibly even a storm about the eastern ranges during the afternoon. But then on Friday, winds are going to tend round to the northwest and freshen up over western and central parts of the state. And that'll drive temperatures into the mid-40s across northwestern Victoria, and probably into the low 40s across the south as well. There will be a cooler, gusty southwesterly change that'll move into the west during the afternoon and move through central parts during the evening, and that'll bring a much cooler, gusty southwesterly wind change during the day. Looks like being a dry change, so unfortunately nothing in the way of significant rainfall with that, but it's likely that we'll see some severe fire danger across the state on Friday. Then much cooler on Saturday, with temperatures dropping by about 10 degrees in most areas, with temperatures dropping to around about the mid-30s across northern Victoria, around about the mid-20s in the south. Unfortunately, only isolated shower activity expected, mainly across the south of the state on Saturday. It looks like there's going to be another follow-up cold front on Saturday night, which will maintain the cooler conditions across the south over the weekend, still with a shower or two in the south, and cooler conditions with temperatures in the low 30s across the north over the weekend. So unfortunately, it doesn't look like there's much in the way of significant rain over the coming week, Nikolai.
Okay, thank you very much, Rod.
No worries.
That's Rod Dixon, Senior Forecaster on duty at the Bureau of Meteorology.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
where it is 26-1. My name's Nikolai Bailhart. So let's turn to broadacre crops now. Australia's drought has meant that buyers looking for high-quality wheat have had to look to some other markets for that product, particularly America and Canada. That's according to Chicago-based agricultural commodities analyst Jack Scoville, who says between droughts, the US-China trade war, and favourable weather across the world, it has been an eventful year for grain production.
We all know about the trade wars going on and the Trump tariffs, especially against China, which have really hurt the U.S. Soybean producer and really helped the Brazilian soybean producer, who has been able to enjoy some very big prices. Then we have some very big production estimates for the U.S. this year for both corn and soybeans, but mostly soybeans. We have a whole lot of soybeans here that we're having trouble selling, once again because of the tariffs, and Brazil producing a very big crop. Over on the wheat side, we're looking at problems with production really all around the world. Our production wasn't huge, but it was a good quality crop. But you look everywhere else, and there were problems. We had problems in Europe, both the European Union and Eastern Europe had problems. On into Russia, some problems along the Black Sea, and also in Siberia. For different reasons, and then down in Australia, the major drought there definitely impacting wheat production, and Argentina currently worrying about too much rain.
Now, with the drought in Australia, now that we're close to the end of the year, what's been the effect, if much at all, of the Australian drought on the international market?
Well, it's been just another kind of a factor in the reduced overall world production. Of course, Russia now is the overwhelming leader in exports into the world market. They've really dominated the world market. So the issues with potential loss of export volume from there has helped really support prices. But then you look at the higher quality wheat, and our wheat quality is better this year than last year, but Australia has always thought of as a very high-quality wheat producer, so it's probably helped support our prices here a little bit, as some of the buyers that would traditionally go to Australia for the high-quality wheat are forced to look elsewhere, and that would be either Canada or the United States.
What about the conflicts around the Black Sea and around in Ukraine, particularly the issue with the Russian Navy, the Navy vessels about a month ago. Was that something that created a lot of fear in investors and traders at the moment, or do they not take notice until it actually affects supply?
I think there was some fear that it could affect supply right away. However, the exports do seem to be flowing from the Black Sea, from both Ukraine and from Russia. So I think that issue has faded in the minds of the traders as something of importance. Of course, if something else were to happen in the region, if a flare up in the hostilities again, absolutely, that would become much more of a market price item.
What are you going to be keeping your eye on in terms of the grain market next year?
First of all, here in the United States, the president did announce that he's going to give the second tranche of support to our U.S. farmers for the losses in the soybeans due to the trade war. That may cause some shifting in acreage expectations for next year here in the United States. Ideas had been that we were going to plant a lot more corn and a lot less soybeans next year. Maybe that won't be the case now with these payments coming from the government. The other thing is, of course, to see the progress of the negotiations between China and the United States and getting these trade disputes resolved. That's going to be very important not only to those two countries, but also to the world market, because if those two economies start to struggle because of this trade war, this tariff battle, you could see economies all over the world suffer, and that would, of course, hurt demand for grain.
That's Chicago-based agricultural commodity analyst Jack Scoville speaking with Lucas Forbes. 22-1 here on the Country Hour. Now to probiotics. You've probably heard about them. They're often touted to help maintain your gut health by using good bugs to kill off the bad bugs. Now a new research project is hoping to use the same principle to fight a serious fungal disease in wheat using fungi. Stephen Wiley and his team at Murdoch University have been awarded a scholarship to investigate this way of improving Stagnospora nodorum blotch, or SNB, tolerance. He says the disease costs grain growers over $100 million every year, and at the end of the two-year project, he's hoping they'll have some answers for farmers.
There have been a number of researchers working on SMB for a number of years, and in every case, really what they're doing is trying to find lines of wheat. You know, there might be wild lines from, you know, back in the Middle East and other breeding lines that have got a higher tolerance to SMB than what's currently around. So, in other words, they're looking for genetic resistance. And that's a well-proven way of looking for resistance to fungi and all sorts of other biotic and abiotic stresses. But we're taking a different approach, one that hasn't been tried before, as far as we're aware. And it's, I suppose the analogy I could use is probiotics. Now, you're probably wondering why I'm talking about probiotics, but probiotics are a range of usually bacteria that people take, perhaps after they've been taking antibiotics for some other disease and they're feeling their stomach's a bit upset. And probiotics are supposed to replace those important gut bugs that have been destroyed by the antibiotic, the good bugs. And so we're using something a bit like that as a different approach to controlling SMB in wheat.
So would you use it, Steve, as like an inoculum or as a foliar application? Or how exactly are you looking to use these probiotics?
Yeah, well, that's a really good question, Tara. And that's actually what our aims are for the first year, is determine the best way of introducing some of these new fungi that we're planning to use against SMB to wheat. So the general idea is that wild plants in Australia, Australian native plants that grow in the desert, that grow in the rainforest, that grow everywhere, are absolutely full of fungi and other things, and bacteria as well, that don't actually cause any disease. And in fact, in some cases, we think they're benefiting the plant in some way. And so we're planning to harvest some of those from the wild flora and introduce them into wheat, and then infect those wheat with Stegonospora and determine whether or not those native plant fungi are protecting the wheat against those.
So you mentioned that this is sort of, it's got multiple parts to this project itself. So how are you actually going to conduct the research? I mean, is it lab, is it greenhouse, is it field?
It's a bit of all three. In the first year, we're going to test a whole lot of different fungi that we've isolated from wild plants, fungi that don't cause disease in wheat. We're going to inoculate them, and in the glasshouse, we're going to challenge those plants with SMB. The ones that we can show are have an improved resistance to SMB, in the second year, we're taking them out into the field. And that'll at least give us some idea whether the approach that we're using is effective. And if it is effective in the second year, then we've got some ammunition to go back to funding bodies and ask for a bit more and do field tests a bit more widely.
So how long do you think it could be before growers actually get something tangible out of this research, Steve?
Well, you know, scientists always say 5 to 10 years, don't they, for everything. So I suppose we would have to be very careful that what we're putting out there is of benefit, that there's no downside to it. For example, in ryegrass, there's a fungus that infects ryegrass. It doesn't have any symptoms on ryegrass, but when sheep eat it, they get what's called ryegrass staggers. And so some of these fungi that we put into wheat may have, you know, other effects, produce toxins that we don't want. So we definitely have to test those really thoroughly, make sure that's not happening. So I suppose the 5 to 10 year time period is about right. The whole concept of using microbes against other microbes has really wide application. You know, not even only in farming, but in human health and even for medicine and for veterinary purposes. So yeah, I think the concept itself has really, really wide applications, and it's becoming something that scientists are really sitting up and paying attention to now.
Murdoch University Associate Professor Stephen Wiley speaking with Tara de Landgraft.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
16 to 1. Well, a soil mapping rover, which is a little machine about the size of a golf cart, could transform the way farmers manage their land. It's being promoted as another way that technology could push agriculture into a digital revolution. Megan Ruth reports.
So just out here, we have a geophysics survey platform. It's got an EM38 at the back. It's got an EM31 at the big white pole there. It's got a gamma ray spectrometer at the front, and these are used to map soils across a paddock.
This is soil scientist Doug Crawford boasting the specs of his electromagnetic ground mapping buggy like it's some kind of sports car, and it's probably close to it in the soil surveying world.
And it's got a differential GPS at the top for recording it. So all the data is georeferenced, so you can put it on a map and it collects, say, 100,000 to 200,000 point data points across a paddock. And it's quite intensive sampling, and so it gives you a good idea of the within-paddock variation.
OK, so there's a lot of technical language here. What you need to know is this surveying system on wheels can map out a paddock complete with individual characteristics of the landscape. Soil scientist Doug Crawford says the days of judging an entire paddock on a single sample are gone.
Most farmers in the past would have made decisions on paddocks on the basis of assuming it's uniform, but nowadays we can pull a paddock apart, spatially speaking, and make decisions about parts of paddocks. So now you're seeing the adoption of variable rate liming, variable rate application of other soil fertilisers and so on. And so this is sort of the new adoption that farmers are transitioning into, this kind of intensive management of paddocks to improve the efficiency of fertiliser use.
Is there a particular farmer or crop that this best suits, or is it across the board?
Well, at the moment, the horticultural industries and the cropping industries are the ones that are adopting this because they see the value for money in it. So the grazing industries are not quite there yet. But they're doing other things to working on, such as cutting their paddocks up into really small units and rotational grazing. So that sort of takes out the broad scale variability to a point.
This intensive sampling system is an example of Victoria's digital revolution in agriculture. Last month in Tatura, the state government launched its multi-million dollar boost for the adoption of technology on farms, like the gadget Doug Crawford uses. So, one last time, what exactly is it?
It's a buggy with lots of instruments attached that produce lots of very confusing data that takes a bit of expertise to understand what's coming out. So it's basically a, how can I put it, it's accelerated sort of the how you can soil test a paddock.
That's Doug Crawford from Agriculture Victoria speaking to Megan Ruth.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Well, butchering animals on farm is something that a number of producers are interested in, but it isn't particularly easy to do. The argument is that animals that are processed outside of big industrial slaughterhouses suffer less, and there's a difference in the taste of the meat. Sally Bryant reports.
It would be fair to say that Michael and Alexandra Hicks are like pigs in mud right now, because after a long, hard slog, they're fully accredited and they're processing their pasture-fed pigs at their own on-farm mobile abattoir in the New South Wales Central West. Michael says they are still working the bugs out of the system, which they've designed themselves.
So that's the fifth pig you've processed today?
That's the fifth pig we've processed today.
It's early days and you're learning it as you go along. Are you happy with that rate of processing?
Yeah, that's not too bad. I mean, we've got to get a bit faster than that.
Because this abattoir is still in an adjustment phase, the workforce today is Michael, his wife Alexandra, and his mother-in-law Bev, who's being paid volunteers' wages.
We took the opinion that whatever we build, there's going to be a chance that it'll be wrong, so we tried to keep it simple enough that it would be easy enough to change. So in reality, we had to use it first to find out what we had to adjust. You know, that was the way it was going to go. So there'll be adjustments I'll make, for sure. There'll be things I'll do slightly differently.
Now, there are three of you working here today. There's you and there's Alex and then there's Alex's mum. Ultimately, how many person project will it be to process the pigs that you've got here today?
Three people. So we're pushing ourselves to make changes to our process, and we require changes to our equipment to make it so that we can do that very efficiently. And our aim is to have a pig going through every 20 minutes, 15 to 20 minutes. That's where I want to get to. We're close today. Haven't quite hit it on every pig, but we will, in, you know, just as we get better at what we do.
Something that's amazing me is you walk all the way out the back, pigs are just chilling.
Yeah, well, that's the great thing. Like, it's no, they're used to the sights, the sounds, the smells, that everything is just a normal day at the office for them. And that's what really excites me about as much as anything. So we've been operating, we've been approved now by the Food Authority. This is our second or third run. And the difference, because we've been butchering our meat here for a while, the difference in the meat quality is just exceptional.
Because this is something you hear a lot from people who are growing animals that are sort of paddock to plate, and they really hate the thought of loading them on a truck and causing them that stress just before they're butchered.
Yeah, and then it's not just the loading on the truck. They land down in an abattoir and they're in a pen next to other animals they've never seen before, some species they may never have seen before in their lives. It's a very strange place, strange smells, strange sounds, all that sort of stuff. And when you combine that with the fact that the abattoir's 3 hours in one direction, it adds a significant impact. And then you go into things like summer. We're trying to dodge the middle of heat in summer, you know. There's lots of challenges for the animals. I'm really excited about that, really excited that we can create, control our standard of high-quality animal welfare right through the whole process.
Now, how big a part of your business model is going to be the concept that you might be able to sell this idea, tested, tried out, worked out all the kinks out of it, to other people who are looking to do the same thing as you are?
I think it's going to be an opportunity rather than a big chunk of our business model at this point. I mean, ask me again in 12 months, that might be different. But at the moment, first and foremost, I'm a free-range pig farmer, and I want to be really great at that, and that's part of this is being part of that loop. But I'm also starting to recognise that there are lots of guys that are having really big challenges in getting access to service kill abattoirs. It's becoming a really big issue across the country.
Alex Hicks says it's been a wild old ride developing their own processing facility, which is effectively a mobile abattoir.
As we went, you're trying to understand what's the next stage of this. How do you build an abattoir? How do you become a meat inspector? How do you become certified? We're sending paperwork into agencies that we're asking for forms. They're trying to find forms because generally abattoirs are closing in New South Wales. It's not often you're opening them. So when you go to open one, people are sort of flustered looking for the paperwork to go, is there an opening form? Like, and they rang when Michael became a meat inspector to say, we've just got your paperwork, we just wanted to confirm which abattoir will you be working as a meat inspector in? We just wanted to put that, you know, write that on the dotted line. They're like, so probably our own. I think that was like silence. And then we've just been trying to figure out all these steps as we go. What's the next thing to become? What's the next certification? What's the next license? What's the next requirement? And so jumping through all the hoops. And building it on a shoestring as well. So for us, lots of secondhand materials, lots of things.
The secondhand material is a bit of a feature though. You've got some very clever, responsible gaming messages around your abattoir.
You know, gambling, you should be on your game. So don't gamble and build an abattoir. So what we did, we were looking for a refrigeration panel, and a guy in Sydney had a huge amount of refrigeration panel that had come out of Star City Casino. So Michael came home with all these panels that have photos of people holding playing cards on them. There's a very attractive lady on the abattoir door in a heart. She's holding the Ace of Hearts, and she's come from Star City. So yes, it's got a bit of a feature there.
So you could realistically say you can get lucky in your abattoir.
That's it.
Sydney-based butcher and providor Grant Hilliard stocks the extraordinary pork. The foods he sells are produced ethically and in holistic and regenerative farming systems. He says this is an important step for Alex and Michael's business, and also for the entire paddock-to-plate movement.
Controlling all the different elements in the process, so that's the important thing for us and also certainly for Michael and Alex. It starts at the level of managing soils and managing water, and both of which Michael and Alex do through judicious rotations and not overstocking their country. And then it goes right through the process of how the animals are treated, how they're raised, whether they've got access to fresh air and sort, in their case, wallows to keep cool during summer. And all of those things play a part. It's a cumulative process, but it also is sort of seated, I guess, in just an approach to animal husbandry where maybe less is more. Through the year, we'd work with 10 to 12 different pork producers in New South Wales.
Would some of your other regular pork suppliers look at that model that they've created and think it might work for them as well?
Well, I think that this is not just other pork suppliers. I think, you know, farmers around Australia are looking at how to take better control of the production system and manage the logistics, including slaughter. It's an ongoing issue for small producers, especially those that want to be able to sell a branded product into the market. And for people like Alex and Michael, who are really trying to differentiate their product, being able to maintain, you know, control over all those steps is vital. I mean, there are a lot of people looking at mobile slaughter options now in Australia. And the Food Authority, clearly in New South Wales, because they've licensed it, but more generally, it's a state-based administrative system with the Food Authority. They're all looking at this much more favourably than they did before. And I think this is very much the beginning of something you'll see more commonly. The important thing to note, though, is that this is possible because Michael has trained himself to be a licensed meat inspector. Because if you have to hire a contract meat inspector, it's around $500 a day, that makes your operation uneconomical.
Butcher Grant Hilliard. Well, it is that time of year when people tend to try and take a few days off, but one Western Australian farmer has gone the other way this year and sailed his first ever Sydney to Hobart yacht race between Christmas and New Year. Robbie Johnson is a farmer from Esperance, east of Perth, and spent the last week as bowman, cook and occasional helmsman on board the yacht Anger Management. He spoke with Tara Landgraft.
Yeah, it was kind of a bucket list thing, and we're all mates and we all sail in Esperance. And when our skipper said, "I'm thinking of doing the Sydney Hobart," this was back in April, I said, "Well, yeah, if there's an Esperance boat in the Sydney Hobart, I'm going to be on it." So we had eight Esperance boys on it and two Perth guys. Yeah, we've been there, done it.
You have indeed. Tell us a bit about the race. You're sort of fresh off the water.
So it's about 630 nautical miles, roughly, if you go straight down the line. The first night we had some really strong winds, 35, 36 knot winds behind us, so we had spinnakers up all night, there was a few masts broken and a few people blew out kites, and we had a really good run down there through the first night. At about the 358 nautical mile post, we were actually in first position. And then I think the wheels fell off. The wind lightened and we got caught in a few holes out there where we just stopped and we're doing 0.0 knots. A little bit frustrating.
Yeah, I can imagine. But overall, not a bad result for a crew which has never raced together before, and many haven't done an overnight race before ever as well, I understand.
No, that's right. No, some of them haven't. A few of us race our own boat. The two professional guys on board were really good. We had a navigator and another sailing guy who is a sailmaker, and they were really good. They've done 9 Hobarts each, so they were fantastic. But the big one is the skipper, the owner of the boat, who made the commitment, Tim Stewart, to do it. It was a lot of time and effort's gone in on his part.
Absolutely. So out of, I think it was 83 boats that started, where did you guys finish, and where did you finish in your category as well?
I think we're about 43rd or 42nd over the line. We finished 7th in our division on handicap.
You must be pretty chuffed with that, Robbie.
Yeah, no, very. We were looking better when we were first, but, our main aim was to finish and do it reasonably well, but to finish, get to Hobart, and we did that. Wasn't looking that likely on the last day. We got half a day from the finish line. We coming around the bottom of Tasmania, and there's a place there called Tasman Island, and we got 40 knots southwesters with it. So it was fairly rough. As if you've seen some photos of us, you'll see what it looks like.
Obviously, now's the time of year that you know things have finished on the farm. Did you do any pre-race training, or does hay cutting count?
I was that flat out. A lot of the boys did a lot of training. I was that flat out on the farm, I couldn't. But it's more, the Hobart's more of a mental thing more than a physical thing. It's, you know, when you're 3 days going through the night with no sleep, still having to get up and do things and concentrate, it's probably more of a mental thing rather than a physical thing. But I didn't actually get all the farm tidied up. We'd hope, I'm mainly cattle and sheep, but we do a bit of cropping, and I hadn't started harvest when I had to come to Sydney.
Ooh.
So they finished harvest just before we started the Sydney to Hobart.
Now, you mentioned you didn't get much sleep, only about 3 hours sleep over the 3 days. Surely you'd be used to that at certain times of year, though, Robbie. That'd be good training for you.
Yeah. Sometimes, yeah, when you spend a few hours on the track, do you? Not quite like that.
Are you feeling a bit more of a sailor than a farmer this week, Robbie?
Oh, well, I haven't thought about the farm, so I'm definitely a sailor, not a farmer this week. It'll be there when I get back.
That's West Australian farmer Robbie Johnson there. And for today, that is the Country Hour.